Welcome to This Week in Energy. My name is Jason Spies. Thank you, folks, for joining us here on the wildly popular radio podcast called This Week in Energy. We've got a fantastic show in store for you. It's National Hispanic Heritage Month. Cara Glenn joins us in the next segment. She runs an organization, Trades Powered by Her. So she's a woman welder who's helping out women in the oil and gas industry specifically. And also, she's from Hispanic Heritage. We have a fantastic interview in store for you.
All right, let's head over to the Zoom line. Mr. Joe Sinnott on the line with us, Whitting Partners, the host of the Energy Detox Podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
It is a beautiful fall day in southwestern Pennsylvania, Jason. I am doing great.
Kind of some big energy news changes we'll get to in a moment here. Expand Energy. But anything happen out in the Marcellus Shale play besides the Pittsburgh Steelers really surprising the NFL?
Oh, Steelers, football season, surprises. I don't know, Jason. I don't know that anything is really a surprise these days. Again, we're in the midst of a heated presidential election here. I think if you're going to talk about surprises or what's going on in the world of Pennsylvania, I think right now, Jason, all roads lead to politics, for better or for worse.
Yeah, they really do, don't they? Of course, Expand Energy, one could argue that's, you know, a political way of doing business now. You know, you take the word oil and gas out of the name and you're now an energy company. And even in some cases, they're now being carbon management companies. What did you make about some of the news this week about Expand Energy and their rebranding, their name merger, if you will?
Well, obviously the merger, acquisition, whatever you want to call it, it was brewing for several months. So that wasn't a big surprise. In terms of the name they chose, I guess it is interesting that they are really leaning into the global impact of natural gas. You know, a lot of different companies talk about the impact of natural gas, you know, well beyond the borders of the United States. And again, you know, they went with a company name that very much speaks to the expansion of our energy resources to places that are all over the world. So I thought that was, you know, interesting, but it certainly, it says something when you go through a big rebrand and you marry that to one of your big talking points and say, hey, look, this isn't just a talking point. You know, this is truly reflective of our strategy, of our business model and our long-term prospects. So again, that's at least that was my interpretation, Jason.
Do you see a rebranding going on within the oil and gas industry right now?
Oh, I mean, nothing that hasn't been going on the last, I don't know, it feels like 5, 6, 7 years to your point, you know, how many companies are removing oil and or gas from their names and going with something that just mentions energy. That's, I don't think it's anything new. And I don't know that I've seen anything beyond what we've already been seeing, which is when there's an excuse, at least, to rebrand. And a lot of excuses are driven by mergers and acquisitions that, again, I would be curious, Jason, I haven't done the research, but I'd be curious how many rebrandings keep or, gosh, even add in the word oil or gas these days.
Yeah, I'd be curious on that myself, actually. Even on some of the local community gas stations, you know, a lot of them are just called so-and-so's last name oil, so-and-so's last name gas. You know, I almost am curious, you know, flash forward 10 years in the future, what that's going to look like. Are those words going to be kind of outdated and just kind of more or less reflect maybe a rural or a small town type of an image? But anyway, I'm just pontificating because I never thought of it like that, where you don't see a lot of, at least, companies adding the word oil and gas, let alone hanging on to it or transitioning into a different word, whether it be energy or carbon management or whatever, you know, maybe just even some word and not even mention anything anymore. So anyway, I don't know if you got any thoughts on that, but that was an interesting take you had there.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's funny your response to that, because I just had a conversation about an hour and a half ago with somebody not related to oil and gas at all, but we were talking about marketing and how often, you know, you could spend you know, companies can spend millions of dollars on advertising, and their consumer or their potential consumer, their potential customer, still doesn't have a clue what they do, what they offer, what their good or service provides. And again, neither of us, me and the person I was talking to, are marketing experts by any stretch of the imagination, but it just, you know, it led to the question, okay, well, you know, are there not more effective, simpler ways to say, hey, this is what we do, and these are the results you can expect if you lean on us for, again, our product or our service. So bringing it back to, you know, oil and gas companies, I guess, you know, what are the trade-offs if you're going with something more generic, if you're using the word energy? Sure, it might speak to the bottom line impacts that you're having on the world, which is to energize the world and, you know, allow people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. But at the same time, you know, are you missing out on opportunities to potentially attract people that, you know, see value in being more explicit about the fact that you deal in the world of oil and gas? And again, we're definitely in more of a pontificating and philosophical mode, it feels like today, Jason, but, you know, clearly there's people that are paid a lot of money to weigh those trade-offs, but, you know, are they truly weighing the potential downsides of rebranding? And I guess, you know, now that we're kind of riffing on this a little bit, for some companies, including one company that I work with in the oil and gas space, you know, they've wrestled with that, right? You know, as they look at new initiatives, greener initiatives, and, you know, logical excuses to rebrand, you know, they have to look very heavily at their employee base, people with decades tied to a company, especially if that company name means something to people. And to strip away that name for something that is, you know, perhaps aligned with the future of that company, still is going to come with the potential trade-offs and hits to morale and engagement among the employee workforce. So again, it's a big equation sometimes, Jason, but you know, obviously the hope is that leaders within these companies are weighing all those pros and cons.
Well, it's more of an adult conversation for sure, because really there's so many layers to what you're talking about. And if somebody's trying to keep a balanced portfolio, or if somebody's trying to manage an investment portfolio on a number of different levels, it would be very difficult, because it would seem to me that the oil and gas reserves would be about the safest investment you could have, next to gold and silver and some other, you know, hard commodities. But the way that the regulations and the public relations have gone over the last 10 years, you almost wonder if, you know, this government grant isn't a safer commodity now than the actual commodity. It's kind of, do you understand what I mean, Joe, where it's very different? Because if you're talking about managing portfolios and investments, you know, that world of uncertainty and regulation can really sway the way somebody looks at their balance sheet, their bottom line. And we're going into, you know, the annual meeting time, you know, October is the starting pistol, right? So interesting times right now for a lot of things, actually.
Yeah, and I mean, and you raise a good point. Hey, you know, portfolio managers are trying to diversify, and they're hopefully looking into the details of all of the various companies that they might be investing in. They're hopefully able to look past a mere name or a tagline that a company has. But at the same time, Jason, excuse me, we're dealing with humans, right? And, you know, even if it just tips the scales just a little bit, the difference between buying a company or investing in a company and not, you know, if a name moves a needle just a little bit, it can have ripple effects. Again, very philosophical. You know, those impacts are, you know, probably almost impossible to see in many circumstances, you know, AI notwithstanding.
All right, man. Well, thanks for the time today.
Thank you, Jason, as always, and hope you have a great rest of the day.
My name is Jason Spies, and you're listening to the wildly popular radio podcast, This Week in Energy. ticking, I think of you. Welcome back to This Week in Energy. My name is Jason Spies. Thank you, folks, for joining us. Coming up next, Cara Glenn with Trades Powered by Her. We're celebrating National Hispanic Heritage Month and Women in Trade.
Is that pretty common for a woman to go back to work in the oil patch after having a child? I guess I never even put that together. I mean, at a bank, yeah, I get it. But, I mean...
You know, that... It's came up, I think, three or four times this year, and that was really the motivation behind it. I had been confronted like, oh, I'm going back to work and, you know, it's a different role or, you know, and so I wanted to be able to help and be like, well, let's, how can we fix that gap that you've, you know, you've been missing work here? Like, how can we advance you? And I think having a really good headshot to add to that resume was kind of my way of trying to get back in there.
Cara things. Glenn is our guest. Trades Powered by Her is the name of her organization. Be sure to check her out on LinkedIn or Facebook. And I'm not really on Facebook, so I don't really follow much on that. But I do follow you on LinkedIn. And I saw one of the clinics you have or one of the different groups that you have was changing a tire. And I think of that Office episode where Pam Beasley went through a season of empowerment, and changing a tire was one of those certain empowerment actions or demonstrations that she did. You know, there is something about being able to change your own tire. I know a lot of men who can't even change their tire. Talk to me a little bit about this Change Your Tire clinic and how that went and what it represents.
Well, that clinic is actually coming up October 12th. And that,
oh, well, hang on, let me write that down. Okay. Well, this is a promo now. Okay.
This
all
is
right.
A promo. Yeah. That's coming up. That clinic is coming up October 12th and it's going to be hosted here at OK Tire. So they've offered to give us their really nice facility and their expertise to host this. And the reason behind this was actually, you know, you move to a city and you can call AAA, you can call somewhere, but I thought it was important here because we've had a couple of years where there was some pretty bad storms and you get stuck on the side of the road. It's honestly dangerous for sometimes, you know, first responders to get out to you for whatever reason. If you had to travel, which we've had to do, or you're leaving work and you've got a, you know, you've only got a little bit of gas or whatever it is. You don't have time to be sitting there in negative 40 waiting for first responders if they can get to you. And so I was like, man, changing a tire in the snow would really suck, but it would really suck if no one could get to you and you had to change it and you didn't know how. And so I want to open this up to women. You know, our first 10 is going to be women, but I believe after this round, we'll see how it goes. I'd like to open it to young men as well. And because I think there are a lot of young men who are not, who are lacking that skill, to be honest. So hopefully we can do both.
I think men of all ages, there's quite a few lacking the skill, but I'm taking a look at your graphic that you have on social media. And folks, feel free to check it out on LinkedIn or Facebook specifically. And it's happening October 12th in Watford City, OK Tire, 10 spaces available. And it looks like there's no cost, huh?
No, we have funding available to do one class for up 10 women. And if it's a hit, I'd like to raise another round of funding to be able to do more. So no cost for 10 women.
Are you doing any of these... Have you done any other classes? I mean, I see your graphics pop up from time to time, and you know, whether it be welding or something like that. Talk to me about some of the other clinics or classes that you've done.
Yep, we've done some weld clinics, and we just did a pilot program. We wasn't really in our schedule to do, but we did a build a skill clinic where we set a price on a project, whether it's like a small welding table or a pipe rack, something small. And I say, hey, this is going to be $300. If it takes you a week, if it takes you 2 weeks, I'm going to give you $300 to build this. I'm going to guide you through it. I'm going to help you measure, cut. I'm going to give you all the skills to be able to do this. And then when you're done building it, you're going to get $300 and it goes to whoever paid for it, you know? And the idea behind that is you see a lot of people saying, you know, oh, this quote drives me crazy. You know, make going into trades just as normal as going into college or whatever the trade is, or whatever the quote is. I just butchered it. But And then no one hires them afterwards. Then you got a bunch of green, you know, tradesmen and women. And I see them on my pages all the time because no one wants to hire these green welders and these green tradesmen. And so what do you do? So my idea was, let's get these small projects. We'll put a set price on it. And that encourages them to pay attention and measure twice and cut once. And it worked marvelously. It worked, I mean, 6 months of welding school, and this girl was doing more in 2 weeks than she did in her whole 6 months. It's working. So that's our build a skill clinic that we just finished.
Build a skill clinic. Okay.
Yeah.
How is the trades going? I mean, that was another story that we did quite a bit on the Crude Life. We spent a lot of time, primarily 2016, 2017, talking about the renaissance and resurgence of these trades, that there are so many companies wanting kids to basically not go to a four-year school, but rather go to a trade school, go learn how to be a welder, learn how to be a plumber, learn how to be a pipe fitter. How's that going? Are you seeing the demand? Is there jobs available?
You know, I see a huge demand. I see both sides. I see a lot of people on our pages, our Welding Women pages, who are looking, actively looking for work. They're all, you know, just got out of college, just got out of a trade school, welding school. And then I see the other side. I see a lot of openings, whether it's in Texas or here. And how do we make these two meet? Because on one hand, the employer doesn't want to hire these, you know, green welders, these green tradesmen and women. And it seems like the very green employee doesn't know how to reach these employers. So how do you bridge, you know, how do you bridge that? And the only way I can think of is to give these green hands some confidence and like, okay, you're not green. You know how to build this, this, and this. And whether it was one small project or, you know, a few weeks in the shop, whatever it is, you've got to build that person's confidence, because there's just so many of these green hands that are coming out and nobody wants to hire them. So, you know, we've pushed trades so much, but yet there's really no invitation into the trades for them.
One of your other social media posts that just stands out in my head is the Chingonga of the week. It's something like that. What is that word? What does it mean? And talk to me a little bit about that.
Oh, the Chingona of the week. Yes.
What is it? Chingona?
Chingona. Yes. That is the bat. That's the badass of the week.
Look at that. Get the mute button ready. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
No, I'm
sorry.
Just kidding. I'm just giving you a hard time. That's one of the words that George Carlin allows us to say.
Okay.
We got one. Is that a Spanish word?
It is. It's a Spanish word. And you know, the story behind that is when I started out as a pipeline welder, I was still pretty brand new. And the Mexican guys, you know, they would never call me by my name. They would always say, you know, and they spoke to each other. They never said this to me, but they would say, oh, I got to go get so-and-so and so for Chingona. And I never thought they were talking about me. And then one day, you know, someone asked me, I don't know, it was a question. And he's just like, oh, the Chingona. He's like, you're the Chingona. And I was like humbled and embarrassed and all these emotions. And so ever since then, I wanted to name, you know, and highlight women who are in trades, you know, highlighting the Chingona of the week. And that was from my embarrassing name that I somehow acquired in the pipeline, but a good name. But that's what our Chingona of the week is women in trades and how they got there and making them a cool highlight on our page.
I had an ulterior motive to go down that path. I knew it was a Spanish word, but I wanted a good segue into National Hispanic Heritage Month, which actually started a couple days ago on September 15th, and it runs through October 15th, which I think is really funny because here you know, Hispanics are doing it their own way. Everyone else, you know, goes from the 1st to the 30th for months. No, not National Hispanic Month. We go from September 15th to October 15th, and I just love that. But
yeah,
talk to me a little bit about National Hispanic Heritage Month, what that means to you, and how you celebrate it within your organization and with yourself personally.
So it's really My Hispanic heritage is very near and dear to my heart because I feel that's where I get my work ethic, my drive. And what comes with that is over the years, I have seen a lot of Hispanic people who, you know, don't speak up on the workplace because, you know, that's the stigma of Hispanic workers, right? It's like, man, they're hard workers. They keep their head down. They nothing out of them, not a peep. They'll come to work. And it's like, yeah, I get that. But are the conditions really good? And are they not speaking up because what, you know? And that's what I tried to dive into with Hispanic Heritage Month last year. And I really didn't get to it. But this year, I really wanted to highlight, and being Hispanic right now is actually very unpopular. So that's kind of a hard deal for me right now because, you know, it's really hard because a lot of my followers and supporters, you know, definitely Trump supporters. So being Hispanic right now, I'm trying to highlight that very unpopular. I'll just say that. But it is important because this is who our workforce is, and we have to take care of our workforce.
Once again, that was Kara Glenn with Trades Powered by Her. There's still more to come, folks, on This Week in Energy. My name is Jason Spies, and you're listening to the wildly popular radio podcast, This Week in Energy. Welcome back to This Week in Energy. My name is Jason Spies. Thank you, folks, for joining us. Coming up next, Warren Martin with Kansas Strong is our special guest.
Yeah, so Kansas, we do have the largest conglomeration of independent oil and gas producers of any region in the world. You know, here in our state, we have almost 2,000 independent producers that are in the state.
Wow.
We only have one company that could even really be considered a major that's doing actual production. We have lots of pipelines, refineries, those types of things. But on the production side of it, we only have really one major company that's doing any significant production in the state. So we are a community of independent oil and gas producers. 89 out of the 105 counties here in Kansas produce oil and natural gas. And so it's pretty widespread across the state. And so what that means for us here in Kansas, especially since Kansas is a red state, so we have a lot higher favorability than some of the other states that oil and gas is being produced in. So we do have a vast majority of people that come by our booth are very supportive of the oil and gas industry. They want to know what we do, how we do it, why we do it. They want to know that information. They want questions answered about what that pumping unit out in the field is actually doing. Why is it not running? You know, and we answer all of those questions. But we do get questions where people come by and say, thank you for all the earthquakes, or thanks for destroying the planet. And those are the conversations I love. Those are the conversations I live for here at the State Fair, because that's where we're able to kind of really break it down and say, why do you think that? Why do you think that the oil and gas industry is responsible for all the earthquakes here in Kansas? Why do you think that we are destroying the earth? And when we're able to ask those questions, then we're able to really kind of begin a conversation where most of the time it turns into a very positive conversation where people acknowledge, I didn't have the slightest clue what I was talking about. I just took the talking points that I got from media and hurled them at you. And that's why we come to the State Fair. We come to the State Fair every year is because we want to have those conversations. And we can sit there at the State Fair. We have a number of volunteers, and we can sit there and we can talk with you until all your questions are answered. And it's really a positive opportunity for the oil and gas industry here in Kansas.
One of the things I loved going to the high schools and the elementary schools and the junior highs were those questions of opposition. Because for me, I was a part of that group. I came from agriculture on the opposite side of the state from where all the oil production was. I literally lived 7 hours from the nearest oil and gas well. So out of sight, out of mind, all we got was the negative type of news. Well, when I started the crude life here, we actually were going to be an investigative against the industry when I first started, because that was what I thought the free market wanted. That was what I thought could actually make some money, et cetera. But I'm a method journalist. I'm like Daniel Day-Lewis of an actor, right? I'm a method actor. So before I write an article on skydiving, I'm going to go skydive, right? Because I want to make sure I understand what I'm writing. So I went and I spent a month out in the oil field, living in my vehicle, living in, experiencing everything they live. And I got such a respect for that industry that now we're on our going on our 13th year of positive petroleum, because I see all the different, I think I've even read 98% of everything that we touch as part of a oil and gas industry. You know, I said 95, but I've seen reports all the way up to 98%. And it's unbelievable when you can talk about your personal experience, how, listen, I know where you're coming from, but you should see what they're doing on the recycled waterfront. You should see how they're helping emergency responders. You should see the checks that are written out to rural firefighters so they can have new upgrade in their equipment that they're mandated to have, that nobody is caring about some volunteer fire department. There was so many positives that came out of the oil and gas industry. And being in Kansas, you might appreciate this, that the agriculture industry, it has problems. It's not as safe as people think it is. And there are some issues, but at the end of the day, the net positive is so positive that you just kind of have to accept reality. And it's hard for the average person to do that when they want to live in a perfect world, when they want to live in the planet of platitudes, if you will. I live in the realm of reality, and I got a big respect for the oil and gas industry. So that is what I like sharing with the kids when they start asking me about all the deer that are dying because of fracking and the earthquakes and all these other things that get exaggerated in the media. How did that happen, by the way, in the media? You know, the oil and gas industry, they do write a lot of big checks to the rural fire departments, and they do take care of a lot of local communities. And when I see how, you know, the media has kind of changed a little bit, you know, we kind of joked, the former mayor of Bismarck and I one day organically on the radio, that when you take a look at science, politics has ruined science, where we can't even agree on what a man or a woman is anymore. So politics has ruined science. You take a look at the economy, boy, politics has really kind of destroyed the economy a little bit too, because now so many companies are reliant on government subsidies or economic development or whatever kind of grant they need. I think politics has ruined politics. I remember when we could have a civilized conversation about left and right issues without getting in fights. Now it's really difficult. I mean, when I take a look at how many things politics has really ruined, I do think politics has really caused a problem with the energy industry and the agriculture industry. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with you. I think that, you know, once something becomes a political issue, science, logic, reason, rationale is all out the window. It's just about winning and losing. It's about winning and losing. And, you know, when you talk about how did we get here with the news, that's pretty simple. Just think about your own casual conversation. When you're having a casual conversation with a loved one and you want to tell them, hey, I've got some news I need to share with you. If it's positive news, you always say, I've got some news I want to share with you. It's positive. You always add that on to the end. Why? Because news has become, it's become associated with negative. It's become associated with problems. It's become associated with those. And so the vast majority of news reporting, that's all it is. Here are the problems. Here's where things are falling apart. Here's what's going wrong. Here, that's what the news is. The news by nature is negative. Occasionally, they'll throw in a positive piece in there to try and balance it out a little bit, to make it look like they're not just the naysayers all the time. But the vast majority of news is negative. So all the stories you're talking about the positives of the oil and gas industry, no one ever reports on those. No one ever talks about those because those aren't news. Those are for the positive stories. And when it comes to this oil company provide uniforms for the volunteer fire department, or that's one story over here. We have another positive story over here where this kid saved this cat from a tree. Which one are we going to give press to? Let's give it to the kid with the cat. And so, you know, that's the role that we're in. That's where we're at. That's why it's incumbent upon our own industry to take that upon ourselves. And so here in Kansas, when, you know, the vast majority of us are independent oil and gas producers, the average company here in Kansas only has 3 employees. The average oil company only has 3 employees. So they don't have a PR department. They don't have a promotions department. And that's where Kansas Strong is so vital in helping to get those stories out, helping to get that positive message out there, because the news media is not going to report on it. It's not news to them.
You know who my favorite interviews are? Is the emergency management directors from each county. I was floored at how much the energy, specifically the oil and gas industry, kept those emergency management people around. Because again, this is where politics, you have some bureaucrat, whether it's in Topeka or whether it's in Bismarck or Washington, D.C. or Austin, Texas, they're making decisions that are blanket. And all of a sudden, these firefighters, which 65% of firefighters are volunteers still, they have to upgrade their electrical equipment. They have to upgrade their communication equipment. These are mandates that they have to upgrade that they can't afford $185,000 for 4 walkie-talkies. That's incredible. And so, you know, here's oil company A or B writing the check out. And primarily because I'm sure that they're being used a lot for those different industries. However, that is, to me, taking on responsibility that you could just pass on to the taxpayer, because at the end of the day, the taxpayer is going to have to foot that bill. That's another example to me that really made the oil and gas industry a positive for me, was how they were the ones that the emergency management directors, they were speaking very positive about. I mean, the one gal in Dunn County, North Dakota, I bet she, for like 5 minutes straight, she rattled off oil company A gave us this much for this equipment, went up and down the line, like I said, from walkie-talkies to scuba self-breathing apparatuses to carbon monoxide detectors to all kinds of different things. How does that work in Kansas with all these smaller companies? I can't imagine that they're able to write big checks out to a lot of these different organizations, can they? I mean, that's tough.
You would be wrong on that account. And in fact, you can go into any area of Kansas, even places where we don't produce oil and gas. Look at any of the nonprofits that are out there. Look at the art centers. Look at the exploration centers. Look at the discovery centers. Look at the theaters. And go look at the roles of the donors that have made the donations to keep those things going, to keep those things moving forward. You will always find oil and gas people that are up there. Here in Kansas, it's a little different, because they don't put the name of their company up there. They just put their name up there.
Once again, that was Warren Martin with Kansas Strong. My name is Jason Spies, and you're listening to the wildly popular radio podcast, This Week in Energy.
Hey, on my mind to the night. Hey, on my hey, life in a northern town.
All right, let's head over to the Zoom line where we've got Mr. Joey Myers with Bay Block LLC. How are you doing today, sir?
Hey, I'm doing okay. How about you?
Hey, not too bad. Not too bad. You're down in Oklahoma, and that's some pretty good energy country down there. Give us a little bit of a background, if you don't mind.
Well, I spent about 25 years in the safety industry. I've been everything from a safety trainer all the way up to director of safety. Before that, I broke out in the oil field. God, I was too young. I was 18 and started drilling when I was 21. So I've been in the patch. I know quite a bit about it.
You've seen quite a bit, obviously, if you started that long ago. I mean, the best way for the listening audience to probably understand the difference between today and then when it comes to the oil and gas industry, I can remember when I was a kid, back in the 70s, we would take trips from Minneapolis to Bismarck, North Dakota, and us kids would be in the back of the pickup truck the whole way. And today the National Guard would come in and put a stop to that real quick if that happened. Just kind of, you know, with a very basic story like that, what do you think kind of is one of those examples of where the oil field was back then and where it is today in regards to something like safety?
Well, safety is basically it. Whenever I broke out there, really, there was no safety. I mean, we didn't even wear full body harnesses in the derrick.
Probably wasn't even FR clothing, was there?
No. You wore a t-shirt.
Yeah.
You wore safety glasses. Well, it's still aluminum hard hat. I still have it. It was aluminum, and people didn't understand it conducts electricity. But anyway, and then as far as safety, but everybody kind of, I mean, there were a lot of accidents back then just because it was the nature of the beast, but you learned a lot different back then. They had to teach you either that or you'd die, in other words, because it was dangerous. It was.
You know, and safety, one of the unintended consequences when it comes to safety is, When somebody gets severely injured or dies on a site, that's when a lot of times you have safety that comes reactive. But there's also proactive safety, and we'll get to that in just a second. But, you know, a lot of people forget that there was a time when there was double digits, people dying on the football field back then, and they went to helmets and they went to pads. And there's like an evolution. I came from agriculture. And that was by far the most dangerous industry for decades. And between tractor rollovers and augers and all kinds of different things that were happening through there. And a lot of that stuff went unreported in the agriculture industry. Oil and gas usually seems to get the headline regardless. So safety is one of the most prominent features when it comes to the oil and gas industry. What's your overall take on where the safety industry is now from where it has been a couple of decades ago? You mentioned a couple of examples, but in my mind, it seems like it is night and day, and the oil and gas industry seems to be proactive now as opposed to reactive.
It very much is. It's more proactive now. There's a lot of stuff that happened back in the 70s and the late 60s I wasn't there in the late 60s, but they almost had to do it. It was just like any other industry. People get hurt. And like you said about the always tell people, you know how regulations are written, OSHA regulations. They're written in blood.
Yeah.
Pretty much somebody has to die. And then they write a regulation to see if they can, and that's being very reactive. Now it's more of a proactive thing with with analysis that you can do risk analysis and certain things. And that's kind of what I think that the whole country needs to go to. They need to be more proactive even now. But, you know, you make mistakes and you won. That's just the way it is. Especially in warfare.
I think it's
gotten a lot better.
So one of the reasons we wanted to have you on today was to talk about the ZAC, the ZAC. Now, this is something that you've put together. And before we get into the actual product itself and what it's doing for the industry, this almost seems like it's a pretty proactive piece of safety equipment, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's very proactive. And that's where we need to be, especially fall protection. You know, I taught safety classes for years. Every time it seemed, I used to teach a class called Rig Pass, and all the rig people would have to go through it before you ever got hired on. Basically, it was a bunch of safety stuff. I did some other stuff. It was how to write JSAs and what to look at. And then you get to the point about fall protection and you tell everybody, well, you know, OSHA dictates that you got to be in fall protection. Depends what industry you're in. Either you're 4 foot off the ground or you're 6 foot off the ground. In general industry, it's 4 foot. But you got to be in a harness and wear a belt. We always told him, says, well, you know, it's required. You got to get in there. You got to get in a belt. But what we didn't tell him is that you can't hang in a belt for over 35 minutes. It's very detrimental to your health. It cuts off the blood flow to your vital organs. It causes long-term medical conditions such as kidney disease. And that's basically why I invented the ZAC, because I've seen some of that. I've heard of a bunch of it, of people, you know, they fell in a belt and they get along pretty good and they says, I'm okay. And then all of a sudden they have major medical problems. And it has to do with, it cuts the blood flow off your organs. And so that's why I invented the ZAC.
Well, I appreciate the time, and you enjoy dinner out with your lovely wife tonight. We'll talk again down the line, okay, sir?
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jason. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to This Week in Energy. My name is Jason Spies. Thank you, folks, for joining us. Coming up next, we talk about carbon sequestration, carbon capture. We head up to North Dakota. Steve Bakken, the former mayor of Bismarck and the current Burley County Commissioner, has a conversation with Lori Hinz of Beck News. Lori has been covering the carbon pipeline proposed by Summit Carbon Solutions on a weekly news update for Beck News, and this is Steve Bakken and Lori Hinz talking about Summit Carbon Solutions CO2 pipeline.
And that was remarkable to me. And egg companies now partner with energy companies to where this seems to be the and I actually wrote about this 12 years ago about the Trinity or trilogy, the triad, if you will, of ag, energy, and carbon, how the three of them really work together at the end of the day. And so now, and I was called crazy, and the oil and gas executives said I had no idea what I was talking about, and it's not scientifically proven, any of this different stuff. And now they're the first ones that are in line looking for those government handouts. And to me, that's the more interesting part of this whole deal, is pretty much every carbon management company that I've interviewed, they've said that the government's driving this whole thing. And to think about that is remarkable, because that is just a government manufactured marketplace. And every one of these Republicans and every one of these different companies that were against this, they seem to be the first ones in line for this. That's scary to me.
It is. It's so interesting, isn't it? How everything in the United States of America has flipped. You're right. The Republicans have become the Democrats. The Democrats have become Republicans, dogs and cats living together. It's phenomenal when you think about it. And I've been thinking a lot about corn lately. Of course, the ethanol plants that we are all talking about are all corn driven. And whatever happened to corn being corn and a food product and being subsidized by ethanol? And is that a Pandora's box? That is the genie is out of the bottle and it can no longer go back to corn just being corn? Is it possible that I remember seeing an article, a few weeks ago now, talking about, I think it was an opinion piece by somebody, and they were talking about, hey, wouldn't it be novel if we actually did crops that actually were not going toward fuel additives? And if we actually started, I've been thinking more and more about corn, especially since on the national level, I keep hearing stories about Make America Healthy Again. And all of the health advocates are talking about seed oils and corn oils and things like that. It's just, it's hard to see how agriculture has morphed into, as you say, rather than a capitalistic organic driven entity into this one where we're worried about capturing carbon from ethanol plants. It's just, it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy when you start with one thing and then you add on top of it. Oh, for instance, if you have medications, you have a medication and you get an unrealized and unexpected downside to a medication. And so you have to take another medication on top of it to take care of the symptoms from the first medication. The same thing has really occurred with agriculture with regard to corn. Is that a highly unpopular thing for me to say?
The article you're talking about came from the Star Tribune. I cannot remember the female writer's name, but it was a very good opinion piece.
Yes, yes.
And the whole corn thing is absolutely remarkable, because if you were to flash forward 20 years in the future, as far as what the UN wants and as far as what the United States government is going towards, there'll be no gas cars out on the roads anymore. It's all electric vehicles. Where the gas is going is to aviation fuel. So it's basically just to make wealthy people transport around faster. And so, well, the people who are paying for all this have to sit and charge their car for 45 minutes to 3 hours. The rich are going to be jet setting all over, working the deals, figuring out the new projects to keep the people busy working. And to me, that's absolutely unconscionable, once again, that there's this level of evil in the marketplace. The other thing that corn does that nobody talks about is it creates high fructose corn syrup. And right. That is the number one cause of diabetes. So when you take a look at our diabetes epidemic, it's remarkable that there is a dialysis shop in almost every strip mall now. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely remarkable to see that there's such a large market for diabetes that somebody can open a dialysis place in a strip mall and not go out of business. That is absolutely remarkable to me. So the whole corn thing goes well beyond ethanol. There's the water issue, the amount of water that's needed in order to grow corn and do all these different things. I saw it happen back when I was, I listened to a lot of, I grew up in farming. So I used to listen to a lot of the uncles and their neighbors talk and things like that. And I heard the conversations when the government forced them to grow corn, wheat, and soy. Because some people wanted to grow other things, but the subsidies weren't there. And then if you didn't have the backing of the government, your crop insurance was unaffordable too. So they almost strong arm you, kind of like how, hey, we'll give you money for the roads, but you got to have a seatbelt law. We'll give you money for the roads, but you have to have your speed limit this. So it's a form of legalized extortion. Mm-hmm. Type of a thing. And so to me, the whole corn conversation is so layered that the average person gets bored really fast and they're going to go on TikTok instead.
Just curious to me that more corn is used for ethanol than anything else. I just never envisioned that, as you say, incentives to do things by the government would be dictating so much of it. I know that the people in North Dakota, and particularly our farmers and ranchers, are very independent people. They are amazing, amazing people. So it's shocking to me, once I have learned about this, that this is a case where, and I am a novice. I am talking out of my butt on this one. So, but I don't like the fact that all of these ethanol plants are so integral to agriculture. It's troublesome to me. It's difficult to see what I envisioned farming and ranching when I was younger to see where we have come most recently, if that makes any sense.
And that was Steve Bakken, the former mayor of Bismarck and current Burley County Commissioner, along with Lori Hinz of Beck News, best of the best just awarded in North Dakota, with her updates on the carbon sequestration pipeline, the CO2 pipeline, spearheaded by Summit Carbon Solutions. And that's going to do it for This Week in Energy. We'll be back next week at this time on this radio station. From the staff at This Week in Energy, my name is Jason Spies, asking each and every one of you to remember, all energy has a purpose, and we are all energy. Go make it a fantastic week. Back to you.